Capital. He's chair of Temple University's Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering. He also directs Temple's Center for Natural Resources Development and Protection. He's a member of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Science Advisory Board, and he's serving on its review panel for its hydraulic fracturing study plan. And Michel Bufado, nice to have you back with us as well.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Abram, let me begin with you and actually begin with some really big questions because I want to make sure our listeners understand exactly what we're talking about. How does fracking or hydraulic fracturing work? That's to you, Abram.
It's a process whereby large quantities of water, chemicals, and sand are injected underground to break apart the rock and release, in this case, gas, in some cases oil. It's a stimulation technique to draw more of the resources out of the ground, and it essentially fractures the rock into lots of shards and lets the resources then flow freely back out. And it uses a large amount of water and creates a very significant waste stream. And so there's significant questions about what happens to that waste stream both underground and back on the surface.
And I do want to ask you about that, but is this a new technique, an old technique?
Well, it's been around for a long time. It's been used in some form for 60 years or so, but it wasn't used frequently until the last decade or so, and also the technology has changed significantly. So both the chemical recipes that are used have evolved to their current form, and also the type of drilling that it's used in has evolved significantly, whereby most wells were vertical and moderately short, comparatively short in length 15 years ago. Now there's, in the shales especially, an increase in horizontal wells, and they just take a much greater volume of water. So the impact of hydraulic fracturing has increased substantially.
And is that because the horizontal wells go deeper?
They go deeper and longer. So to fill them with fluid takes an astronomically larger quantity of fluid.
And we're talking about huge quantities of water. We're also talking about sand and chemicals. What is in this cocktail, as you describe it, Abram?
Well, it's a mixture of all sorts of things meant to both control how smoothly the fluid flows into the well and what happens down there to kill bacteria and so forth. It can, in some cases, include, it has historically included, diesel components, benzene, chemicals called 2-butoxyethanol, which have some known health effects, and a suite of other materials. There's been some mystery around the complete recipes. We know more now than we used to, but for a long time the industry kept secret what they were pumping underground, and that's been one of the real challenges in this issue.
Do we know exactly the kind of chemicals, or is this a sort of an evolution, Abram?
We, the public, still don't know every single chemical that's pumped underground. While we have more information than we did a year or two ago, there's no guarantee that we have every single bit of information. The EPA may be learning more now as a part of their current review process. As of a year ago in my interviews, they also did not know exactly what was being pumped underground.
But the industry knows.
The industry knows.
Michel Bufado, let me get you in on the conversation. Do you know more about the chemicals used in fracking?
In essence, the chemicals are proprietary, so we don't have access to them. Some companies they actually list the chemicals on their websites, but as Abram mentioning, there is no clear policy for disclosing all the chemicals that are used.
And why is that, Abram?
Well, it's they're generally protected as trade secrets. The analogy that the industry uses is Coke protecting its recipe from Pepsi. They say that theirs is a very competitive market, and sharing the information about what they put underground would essentially share their successful processes with their competitors. I think it's convenient and maybe more important that it also protects that information from oversight by regulators and from the public.
How does the Clean Water Act factor into this?
Well, the Clean Water Act governs what happens with water handling and disposal above ground. The Safe Drinking Water Act handles what happens underneath ground. The Safe Drinking Water Act has been the main issue here because there's an exemption that was put into law in 2005 as part of the Energy Policy Act, and that exemption basically said that hydraulic fracturing cannot be regulated under the Safe Drinking Water Act as a form of underground injection, which is essentially what it is. It hasn't directly affected the secrecy around the chemicals, but it has prohibited the EPA from stepping in and demanding certain regulatory processes, certain degrees of preparation and oversight and well construction guarantees and all sorts of things that while they might not stop fracturing, would probably keep some of the contamination incidents that we've seen from happening.
So in order to change that, I would have to go back to Congress. Congress would have to weigh in on that or change that, Abram?
That's exactly right. At least in order to regulate hydraulic fracturing under the Safe Drinking Water Act, an act of Congress is needed.
Let's talk about the water and what happens, I guess, to this water. And I'll start with you, Abram, and then, Michelle, I'd like to get you back in on the conversation. But we're talking about, as you say, Abram, lots and lots of water. I don't know how many millions of gallons that we're talking about in a well. But how is that water dealt with?
Well, in Pennsylvania, the largest wells have used up to 6 million gallons of fluid. The water is taken from a source, which is one point of controversy, whether it's taken from the Delaware River or a smaller upstream source. It's trucked with thousands of trucks to a well site. It's mixed with its components, which we've described, and then it's pumped underground under extremely high pressure. In Pennsylvania, industry tells me that as much as 85% of that fluid then remains underground, which is also concerning, considering mm-hmm. that I have not seen good research or good published documentation guaranteeing that those fluids are held in place underground. What comes back out of the ground is kind of the focus of the controversy we've heard over the last couple weeks. We reported back in 2009 that Pennsylvania and New York both did not have the capacity to treat the wastewater that was going to be produced from the drilling fields. There's not enough waste treatment plants, and the waste treatment plants that we looked at that were licensed to handle the waste weren't going to be able to take out the kind of contaminants that we could presume would be in the waste. What we've learned in the last couple weeks is that is, in fact, turning out to be the case, that large quantities of this wastewater are being dumped into the river untreated, that it can contain some amount of radioactive materials, though it's not clear that that's enough to be a health risk, and essentially that the state is behind in its processes for handling the results of the hydraulic fracturing operation.
Let me go back to you, Michelle Bufadel, and talk about the treatment facilities for wastewater. Can they handle the kind of water that comes from fracking?
The current municipal treatment facilities, no, they don't, the traditional ones. So, but of course, the technology exists to for treating that water. But the cost of treatment then becomes an issue. Whereas a treatment facility, a municipal wastewater treatment facility, would cost maybe 7 cents for a gallon. If the process become more specialized, it can go up to 30 cents per gallon. And I think that's the problem here, because it's not about treating 1 million gallons. It's mm-hmm. about treating 50 million gallons and 100 million gallons.
But just so our listeners, and frankly, so I understand then, but if it's being treated through existing wastewater treatment plants, they're really not treating the water from gas drilling, yes?
Correct. Well, what's happening is the following. Now, once you have the injection of the water is before it gets injected, it's mixed with, for example, gel to make it more slippery, friction reducers, and some of these actually they tend to cause microbial growth. So there's biocide that is added to the water, and then once the gel goes into the well, you don't want it to stay there for long, so there's other chemicals that cause it to break. So all of these chemicals, they are industrial quality in general, and then along with sand, and they are injected in the formation. They prop the rocks open, the sand grains go into these crevices of the rocks, and then the gas starts flowing. Well, before the gas starts flowing, the water now is pumped back, you know, maybe 25% of it. So in the process, it picks salts, calcium, chloride, and radioactive matter, uranium and the radium. So now we have this water that we need to treat, and it has a very high salinity. So
very salty.
Very salty. The salinity is six times that of seawater. And there is no method to treat it in these plants, so the approach has been diluting it.
Diluting it into the rivers or
by blending it with other waste water. And so that's one of the concerns. But then by doing so, there is no treatment for the radioactive matter, and there is no treatment for the some of the organics.
Abram, let me go back to you, and we're going to have to say goodbye to you in just a couple of minutes here, but I'm quoting from the acting DEP Secretary Michael Kranzer, and this was in response to the charge of radioactive material in some of this wastewater. He said, here are the facts. All samples, and there were samples taken, were at or below groundwater levels for radioactivity, and the all samples showed levels below the federal drinking water standard for radium-226 and 228. In a sense, challenging, I guess, both your research and also the New York Times.
Yeah, I don't think, honestly, that he's challenging our research. It may be the case that, those radium levels are diluted sufficiently by the time they're in the mainstream of the rivers to not pose a threat to human health. What isn't discussed by either the DEP or in the New York Times article is the risk that exists from this radiation as it accumulates both in the waste masses from the treatment plants and in the pipes and facilities and machinery that's in the drilling fields. And that's a lot that's a significant part of what we had reported about in the past. The accumulation can lead to higher levels of radiation over significant amounts of time in those period in those materials and can lead to radiation deposits in the waste stream or in the steel yards where scrap pipes go and things like that. It might be a risk to workers in the field. What's significant about the wastewater treatment is not only the questions about which the DEP appears to be answering about what the levels of radiation are, but that the testing hasn't happened regularly and significantly, and I think that still needs to happen, that water treatment plants along the Delaware River and elsewhere need to be testing regularly for radioactivity levels.
Well, Abram, we're going to pick up on that with two guests, one waiting in the wings, one here in our studio, and thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times. Much more to talk about.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. That's Abram Lustgarten. He's a reporter for ProPublica. We will continue our conversation talking about natural gas drilling and its effect on the quality of water in Pennsylvania, and we'll be taking some calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Tchaikovsky's Second Piano Concerto has lived too long in the shadow of the immortal first. Pianist Stephen Huff joins the Philadelphia Orchestra for a rare performance of Tchaikovsky's Second Piano Concerto. Call for your tickets, 215-893-1999, or order online this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center. Tchaikovsky's Second Piano Concerto with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Next time in Studio 360, sex, lies, and a curtain call. Filmmaker Steven Soderbergh says goodbye to Hollywood.
When you reach the point where you're like, if I have to get into another van to do another scout, I'm just going to shoot myself. It's time to let somebody else who's still excited about getting in the van, get in the van.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Invitational Furniture Show supports WHYY and has been bringing together artists and patrons for over 17 years. The show runs from Friday evening, March 25th, to Sunday the 27th at the cruise ship terminal in the Navy Yard at the south end of Broad Street. Featuring modern and traditional tables, chairs, beds, desks, lighting, and tabletop items. For more info, philaifs.com. The Philadelphia Invitational Furniture Show. Invest in beauty.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We are talking about the effects of a drilling for natural gas on the quality of water in Pennsylvania. And again, Michelle Bufadel, chair of Temple University's Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering, is with us here in our Philadelphia studios. He also directs Temple's Center for Natural Resource Development and Protection, and he's a member of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Science Advisory Board, also serving on its review panel for its hydraulic fracturing study plan. And listening to the first portion of the show, and now joining us is David Yoxheimer, and he's an extension associate with Penn State's Marcellus Center for Outreach and Research in the College of Earth and Mineral Sciences. And David Yoxheimer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And again, we've got a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. David, let me just give you a chance to weigh in. Should Pennsylvanians be worried about the quality of their water as a result of drilling techniques in Pennsylvania?
Well, I think what we need to do is institute more routine monitoring of both groundwater sources and surface water sources, especially those surface water sources that are receiving the effluent from the treatment plants that handle the flowback waters. You know, the DEP did collect some data last year, and I think we need to continue routine monitoring to ensure that, for one, you know, we aren't impacting water quality and therefore potentially impacting human health. And we also need to look at minimizing that waste stream. You know, the industry is using, on the order of 70% of their, reusing 70% of their flowback waters for subsequent hydraulic fracture, and I think we need to continue to get closer to 100%.
Let me go back to Michelle and both Abram, and we're hearing from David as well, talking about the importance of testing. I don't think anyone could argue with that. Mm-hmm. Do we have the kinds of testing abilities to really get to the questions about contaminants in water or concerns about water?
Well, in terms of surface water, I think we do. But I would prefer that we test the source water, the water coming to the plant, because at that moment it might be easier to treat it rather than to let it go through the plant and then test downstream of the treatment plant.
Let me just stop you there. You're talking about the water even before it's used for the fracking?
No. I meant, I should say, the source water. I meant the flowback water. When it is brought to the treatment plant, it would make sense to test for radioactivity and the organic content then, because sometimes it might be easier to target certain compounds when they are in concentrated form rather than when they are in diluted form.
I mean, that seems pretty basic, isn't it? I mean, I'm not a water tester, but that seems kind of basic to research, doesn't it?
I think it will be better to test them, yes, before you send them through the plant, and that will allow optimization of the treatment. I am, of course, supportive of what the gentleman mentioned, monitoring streams. I think that would be that gives us an idea or part of the picture. One of the issues that we need to also monitor is groundwater, and for two reasons. One is the operation of hydrofracking. We don't know how high up injected fluid would rise after they are injected. So, essentially the upwelling of the fluids. Talking with the industry expert, they indicate to me that the chance is remote, and I tend to agree with them. But I think, as a scientist, I would like to assign a value to it, to know literally what are the odds. Mm-hmm. And there needs to be some studies in that regard based on modeling, computer simulations, and we're doing some of that in our labs. So because such studies would allow us to determine where to sample in the groundwater. The same thing in regard to, let's say, once you have the well pad and there are these pits where they put the flowback water on a temporary basis, they could leak, and then depending on the properties of the fluid, the emplacement of monitoring wells become important. Now, I do know, I know that some of the companies, they stopped using pits, and they use steel containers, which is really commendable. But still, there are other industry that they are using lined pits, and there's a clear history, the record, that they do rupture, and then the flowback water leaks down the aquifer.
Let me just stop you there. Let me go back to you, David Yoxheimer, and picking up on what Michelle Bufadel said about groundwater. Is that important to be able to test the groundwater and see what's there?
Yeah, absolutely. As Michelle had said, Out in the field, many of the companies have now switched over to more closed-loop systems, so there is less potential for any spills or leaks out in the field, because if there were, it would certainly, the flowback water would have an opportunity to seep down into the aquifer system. The other thing that many companies are doing out in the field now is actually lining their well pads. So if there is a spill, I mean, their impoundments are already lined and do have to meet DEP specifications. So there is that, and they also do need to have groundwater monitoring in place at those pits that do, or those impoundments that do store the flowback water, and they're double lined and have leak detection systems in them and things of that sort. But on the actual well drilling operation, on the well pads, there's a lot of chemicals, there's fuels being handled there, and so many companies are now lining those pads. So if there is a spill, they actually have vacuum systems on site that they can suck it up before it would have any sort of environmental consequence.
But I wonder, I mean, where, and the governor has said he wants us, Pennsylvania, to be, you know, the Texas of the North when it comes to gas drilling. And it seems that, David Yoxhammer, we still have questions about the impact of drilling on water quality, water supply. Do you think there needs to be, if not a moratorium, at least a time to sort of catch our breath and see the effect of drilling? Because it seems to me the more wells you have, the more potential for something dangerous to happen.
Well, sure. The more drilling that occurs, the more there is potential. But to minimize that potential, the industry needs to employ, you know, best available technologies and management practices out in the field, which, again, they are certainly out there improving their practices to minimize the environmental impacts. And, you know, as we said before, we do need more water quality testing out there. The treatment plant are allowed to accept the flowback water, actually do have to test that water before it arrives at their facility, so they know what's coming into their plant. But I would agree with Michelle, what we need to do is more testing on the backside of the plant just to see how effective the treatment is. Some of those plants do some of that monitoring on some level, but I think we need to do a fuller suite of analytical work to make sure that we know how effective the treatment is and minimize the amount of flowback water taken to treatment facilities in the first place.
Is there some urgency with this, Michel Bufato?
The urgency in terms of...
Just knowing what we're dealing with.
Well, I mean, talking with the state officials, DEP, they are saying that they are playing catch-up, and, because of this gold rush. I think the DEP, for example, they hired many inspectors, I think 70 or 80 inspectors, but then a large percentage of them left after a few months to work for the industry. So
that's troublesome, isn't it?
I would say so. And I think the techniques, when someone contacted me and say, for example, how about a monitoring or a groundwater monitoring, I think the techniques that are being used by DEP are adequate. But I think we need to look at the issue at more large scale, in a cumulative scale. If we take the problem at Dimock, it was obvious that it was a faulty casing. But what we could learn from that is that the faulty casing resulted in the gas not just flowing near the well, it just, traveled distances away from the well. And these are the issues that of concern. Once we have many companies operating and then there are problems, it might become very difficult to ascertain who is the liable party. Mm-hmm.
Let me reintroduce the two of you. That's Michel Bufato. He's chair of Temple University's Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering. David Yoxhammer joining us by telephone. He's an extension associate with Penn State's Marcellus Center for Outreach and Research in the College of Earth and Mineral Sciences. And one of several interviews we've been doing about natural gas drilling and Marcellus Shale here in the state of Pennsylvania. Just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get some callers in on the conversation. We have Sarah from, looks like Port Matilda. Port Matilda, go ahead, Sarah. You're in Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm actually in David's backyard, as he probably recognizes, and just this year in January, the Center Daily Times reported that there have been over 1,600 violations by 43 companies in just a two-year span. And I'm wondering, do any of your guests know how well-funded or how adequately staffed the Pennsylvania DEP is to keep up with this industry? Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah, for calling in. And David, since that's in sort of your own backyard, your thoughts?
Yep, sure is. Hi, Sarah. The DEP has actually more than doubled their inspection staff in the last couple of years. So they went from on the order of 88 inspectors to on the order of 202 inspectors the last count I heard. So they've definitely, while they have lost some staff to the industry, they've also made significant gains. And so, to have that number of violations, you certainly need a lot of people out there overseeing the operations. And so, and of the 1,600 violations, many of those were fairly administrative in nature. If you actually go through that data and look at the actual number of environmental incidents, it's actually a pretty small fraction.
And what should we expect, you think? I mean, what should be the standard, Michel Bouffedel, for violations and what is an acceptable risk?
Well, I think that's the key point here. Is the key word is risk, and we need to have risk assigned to the whole operation. In previous public meetings, our approach, what I propose is to deal with this issue of risk the same way we deal with the floodplains. We drew floodplains, we said the risk of flooding in any particular year is 1%. So I think that's how we should approach this. We should say that at this particular location, this particular locale, if you have three wells, the risk would be such. If it is five wells, it would be, so and so. And I think that's the only way we can deal with this as a community. And then as a community, then we decide. We say, do you want to live with this risk or not?
Let me see what Chris from Bethlehem has to say. And Chris, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I recently took some students up for a fact-finding trip to Bradford County, and we had a good time checking it out and learning about that. Saw all the trucks. And I guess, it's fossil fuels are, what they are, and, nothing's perfect. But we're perforating the Marcellus Shale with, thousands of holes, and then when we're done extracting the gas, we plug up these holes. So what's the life expectancy of these concrete plugs? I mean, eventually they're going to fail, aren't they? 400 years, 500 years?
Chris, it's another good question. I'm going to toss it first to you, Michel, and then to you, David.
There's a chance that a percentage of them would fail, and that's an issue of investigation. Of it requires research. I mean, I know it's not the best answer I could give because you want a yes or no, and then you say we need more research. But I think the whole issue of Marcellus Shale requires more science, and then not one study or two. I mean, numerous studies, and they complementary to address these issues. Some answers could be kind of found approximately using computer simulation, to predict. I mean, and we have the capability. I'm saying we at Temple, but a nation. There are many entities. Berkeley have this capability. So to conduct numerical simulations and then to see what are the odds, what is the likelihood of something like this happen. Of course, one could learn from what is being done for carbon sequestration. So there are similarities, but I think for the Marcellus Shale, what we need to know more, I believe, is more of the geology and the fractures in the ground. Because if you have an injection and then the fluid rises from the shale layer, rises 1,000 feet, most likely it's going to stay there. But then if there's another, if there's refracking after 5 years, well, that fluid is going to rise higher. Maybe if there is another well next to it that gets fracked. So all of these issues, they need to be considered to have a conclusive answer in terms of the risk.
Do you want to weigh in on that, David?
Yeah, I think I'd have to sort of punt on the yes or no aspect of that, and we do need some more research on what is the sort of the shelf life of an abandoned well. You know, when they do abandon a well, they do use, you know, cement and sealants that are specifically for that purpose. So they do have, a relatively long sealing capability. Just how long, you know, it's a great question. I guess, you know, it's the same kind of thing you would have to ask of a, say, a landfill and its liner, and how long will that hold, you know. So someday you may well, in fact, have to go down and, re-drill out the well to reseal it. But again, some more research is needed in that arena.
Do you imagine, though, David, that it would be, it looks like this is going to happen, drilling in Marcellus, the techniques of drilling can be more modernized. You can use less water, less effect on the water supply.
Yeah, actually, you know, there are folks here at Penn State who are looking at ways to optimize the process that would, minimize the amount of water needed to hydraulically fracture the shale, and therefore minimize the amount of flowback and wastewater that's produced from the operation.
You nodded your head, Michelle.
Yeah, I agree, and I think talking with the Susquehanna River Basin Commission and with the Delaware River Basin Commission, I think in terms of water supply, they have very strict guidelines on from where to withdraw the water. So I feel that in terms of water supply is not a big issue at the larger scale. Maybe locally it could have an impact on the ecology, something that some people call environmental flow, essentially that... If let's say in a river, the flow at a certain moment is expected to be 3,000 CFS, and now it is 1,000 CFS. It's not very low, but that difference in flow might affect adversely the ecology, because the higher flow is needed during certain mating season for some animals. So I think there are sometimes there could be some impact, ecological impact that result from withdrawal. But at this, but the way it seems to me at this moment, the water supply is not a crucial problem.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. And that's Michel Bufadel. He's chair of Temple University's Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering. David Yoxheimer, an extension associate with Penn State's Marcellus Center for Outreach and Research in the College of Earth and Mineral Sciences, talking about drilling for natural gas in Pennsylvania and its effect on water. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Cookways at Gwynedd supports WHYY. Guided by time-honored Quaker values, Folkways is a continuing care retirement community for adults 65 and over. Since 1967, Folkways has been providing its residents with a comprehensive health program and financial stability. Folkways is committed to friendship, caring, and respect as a way of life. For more information or a personal tour, the number is 215-283-7010.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll have the latest on Japan's nuclear power plant. Also, a Massachusetts town tries to reach its Japanese sister city. And tax tips. What's deductible if you're unemployed? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit have been studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders since 1964 and are currently performing research to develop improved treatments. Symptoms may include mood swings, depressed mood, anxiety, and low motivation. Initial evaluations are offered to determine those who are eligible for treatment. More about Penn's Depression Research Unit at 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. We are talking about the natural gas drilling boom in Pennsylvania, fueled in part by the nation's search for more energy, the gas-rich Marcellus Shale, and a drilling technique that's known as hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. Drillers use enormous amounts of water along with sand and chemicals to break apart the rock that's deep in the ground, which then releases the gas. And there are concerns about the effects of drilling on water quality in the state. And we're talking with David Yoxheimer and Michelle Bufado about this type of drilling and its effect on water. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. David, let me just quote something from John Quigley. He was the Secretary of Pennsylvania's Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. And he's quoted in the New York Times in this article saying, "In shifting away from coal and toward natural gas, we're trying for cleaner air, but we're producing massive amounts of toxic wastewater with salts and naturally occurring radioactive materials, and it's not clear we have a plan for properly handling this waste." And I hear from both of you that there's a need for more research, but that quote from the former state official here in Pennsylvania, I think, is quite concerning. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, you know, the treatment plants that are permitted to handle it, there's about 14 plants around the state, on the order of six municipal plants and eight dedicated oil and gas treatment facilities. The dedicated plants use a process known as chemical precipitation, and what that does is it drops out the metals in the wastewater, and actually the radionuclides tend to drop out along with that, and so that significantly reduces the concentrations of any, not only the metals, but also any radionuclides that would be in the water that would ultimately discharge into a receiving water. The municipal plants that are permitted to handle it are only allowed to handle a maximum of 1% of their average daily flow as backwater.
Right.
And so there, then you have a 99-to-1 dilution factor right off the bat. Now, again, not to say that that's, you know, the best means of disposal, but, you know, there are treatment levels and dilution factors that go into that. And that's, you know, I think reflected at least on some level with the DEP's recent analytical data from the streams.
We touched on this earlier. Michelle, you want to add to that?
I want to just comment that I believe that uranium actually doesn't precipitate as well as radium and the other radionuclide. Now, in terms of the 1%, I think the rationale most likely was the dilution of the salinity. So because
the saltiness.
So if you have 100, you want to go from 100 gram to half a gram per liter, 100 gram per liter to 0.5 gram per liter, and I think that was the rationale, I think, for the dilution. Apparently it works in that regard, that you obtain salinity that is acceptable to discharge into the streams. Though the other compounds, I'm not sure that they get treated in these plants.
And that's your concern?
Well, it is a concern, because these plants, they are not designed to treat for example, benzene or toluene, and you know, if the metals, I'm hoping all of them they settle, but there could be some of them they would not settle.
David, what would the effect of drought be on the handling of water when it comes to drilling, whether it's getting the water from the streams or the rivers or putting it back in?
Yeah, well, this past summer we had a fairly dry summer, and those companies that have surface water intakes, many of them were basically shut off from their water source because they have to leave a certain amount of flow in the stream, and if there's a certain threshold at which they reach with low flow, they're not allowed to pull any more water out of the stream. So many companies, again, were sort of shut off from their sources. And on the wastewater end, if you have lower flows in the streams, but you still have the same level of wastewater discharges, then you're going to see contaminant levels increase in a stream from any discharge. So whether it's a a chemical manufacturing plant, a wastewater treatment plant, or a plant designed to handle oil and gas waste.
Because you can't dilute it the way you would with a full stream, right?
Right. When you don't have the higher levels of natural flow in a stream, it's just, you know, kind of simple math as to what the dilution factor is or is not going
to
be.
Go ahead, Michelle, and then we'll get to our callers.
And there are a couple of issues I would like to just discuss them more with Dave. The sludge, I mean, once we precipitate these metals, a radionuclide, and now we're going to have sludge that is radioactive. So that's going to, we need to treat it differently than other sludges where we just take them to a regular landfill. The other concern is the presence of bromide in the water. And bromide, essentially, when it goes through the, for drinking water, when it goes through the disinfection, and depending on what is being used, you could have the generation of what they call THMs.
THM,
and trihalomethane, and these are actually carcinogen. Oh. So the concentrations has to be very small, 80 parts per billion. But nevertheless, it is best to treat, to get rid of the bromide before the water enters into the stream. So that also adds to the cost of treating the water.
Let me get to Frank from Huntington Valley to join our conversation. And, Frank, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Marty,
yes.
The question, can I be heard?
Yes, you're on the air. Go
okay,
ahead.
Okay, all right. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, okay.
The question back a little before 10:30 that was brought up, not directly relating to the technology of this procedure, but it was said that some of the inspectors had left and gone with the company.
Right.
You remember that?
Yes,
and
I
said
do.
It was troublesome.
Yes.
And I thought Michelle Bufato had agreed with you, and correct me if I'm wrong, I thought he had kind of said, you know, agree with you. But then I noticed the subject was dropped, and my question is, what is happening here that inspectors, is it a question of economics? They're paid more? Would that be the reason they go with the company?
Well, Frank, let me toss it back to Michelle Bufato, and we'll get David Yoxheimer in on it as well.
Yes, ahead, I mean, that was the... I will provide even the public forum when I remember. The reason was economical, as it was explained to us.
The idea that they got paid more?
I mean, they got paid more, and that's why.
But the reason I said it's troublesome is just that you've got inspectors, you know, working for companies, and then you wonder sort of where people's loyalties lie. David Yoxheimer, do you want to weigh in on that?
Well, yeah, I think you know, certainly the natural gas industry is going to have wages that are, you know, 30-40% higher on average than other salaries out there. So I'm sure, you know, the economics of it weighed in for those people to make those decisions. But you know, I think the DEP has a qualified staff out there, and I would like to think that they're not going to you know, give their ex-coworkers shortcuts around the legal procedures that need to take place to get their permits. So you know, I'm not aware of any favoritism, if you will, on that level, because I think you know, the inspectors we have out there are, you know, good folks that are taking their job seriously and you know, making sure things get done the right way.
And David, do you think there are enough inspectors to keep up with the drilling?
You know, there's on the order of 100 drilling rigs in the state right now. We've got you know, just over 200 inspectors, so I would say that, you know, there's two inspectors per rig if you do that math. You know, I think we always could use more inspectors out there. I'll say that just to make sure that, you know, everything is occurring according to the regulations out there.
Now, I'm reading something in the Philadelphia Inquirer that there are 2,800 shale gas wells in Pennsylvania, and you said there are only 100, David?
No, 100 drilling rigs out there.
Oh, drilling rigs, okay.
Yeah, actively drilling.
Which is different from the several thousand wells.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, so there are about 2,800 wells to date drilled in Pennsylvania, about a third of which have actually been hydraulically fractured.
Yeah, I guess David's point is that the inspectors are needed during the drilling when the rig is there. And I think I agree to this extent that, yeah, you know, there's more action, but But I think the whole operation takes so many days, so I'm not sure the inspectors are physically there all the time. But anyway, I mean, the high number is good. And I also agree with Dave that I don't question the professionalism of the DEP staff that are working. So I know they're doing their best. Some of the issues that we keep coming back to, I'd like to raise, which is that, you know, we need more science because just going to a site and inspecting it's mostly to see how the operation is going. We need more science in terms of monitoring the operation, and some of the information is available with the gas company, but they are proprietary. So if they can release them to the DEP. Or to any other entity, and with the confidentiality agreement, I think that will kind of open up the discussion, and then would alleviate some of the concerns that people have. You know,
more transparency.
Transparency. I mean, to me, it's like the injection at 8,000 feet. You know, the chance of the fluid rising to the surface. I would like to think it is small. Mm. I think it is small, but I would like to assign a number to it.
Let me get Randy from Berkesey to join us on Radio Times. And Randy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question for David.
Sure.
I was wondering if it's true that your department receives funding from the gas industry, and if so, you know, how does that affect, you know, the research, or, you know, or are you providing any spin for the industry?
David,
right.
Go
actually,
ahead.
Our center receives no external funding. Penn State funds our group internally because the university recognized the need for public education out there and for unbiased research. Now, yeah, does Penn State receive funding from the industry to do research? Absolutely, just like any university out there receives funding from any industry. So, you know, that's what funds the students, the grad students, to do the work they need.
Randy, thanks for the call. Let's see what Jane from Bristol has to say. And Jane, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. For taking my call.
You're very welcome.
One of the concerns I really have, and that doesn't seem to be discussed as much, is that there are serious implications for water quality from the above ground development of these gas wells. When you're talking about well pads that are up to 5 acres in size, you get a lot of sedimentation and erosion going on. When these are developed on either farmland or forest land, you get habitat destruction, and all of that is going to have water quality impacts, especially when you have increased industrialization and you get infrastructure with roads and pipelines and, you know, all the truck trips going back and forth. You're going to get a lot of erosion and sedimentation into the streams, and that's going to have a massive impact on water quality, especially on the critters in the streams, such as the macroinvertebrates and mussel populations, that one of their important ecosystem functions is water filtration to provide for clean water.
No,
and
fair
I
enough.
Don't feel that Pennsylvania regulations are doing an adequate job of examining that, and I certainly don't think the Delaware River Basin Commission is taking an adequate look at that in its draft regulations.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times, Shane. Let's see what Michelle Bufadel said.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that this is a valid concern. I'll give you also another example that, you know, the well pad, initially, when one looks at it after it is constructed, one sees green. And then it's assumed.
You mean it looks green?
It looks green. I mean, you know, it's because it is planted after, you know, the drilling. But beneath that, the soil is heavily compacted. So whenever, you know, water rains there, it's not going to percolate in the ground. It's going to run off. So it does increase runoff, even if it is vegetated with some some grass. So these are some serious concerns. The forest fragmentation is another concern, you know, what you mentioned in terms of siltation of streams. I think all of these issues should be considered in a life cycle analysis point of view, kind of from cradle to grave, to see what happens for that drop of water that leaves the pad and then what are the impact of it. And I'm not aware of any study that addresses this problem in a very integrative way.
David, we're almost out of time here. The final question to you, just picking up on what Michel Bufado said, and frankly what our callers have been saying, which is that there is a lot of concern about the effect of drilling on the quality of water. There's much that we still need to know and understand. Do you have confidence that the state can deal with some of these questions?
Yeah, I mean, I think we certainly face challenges to minimize the potential for water quality degradation. However, I think a lot is being done. You know, the DEP has passed new water quality standards from new treatment plants. The industries are using engineered well pads in the fields to reduce the amount of erosion and sedimentation. Those pads do need to be reclaimed within 9 months of activities ceasing on the well pads and revegetated. So while it's certainly a temporary disruption out there, once things are reclaimed, things are put back in place, but there's always going to be potential. It's an industrial operation out there, and so again, we need to make sure that the industry is cooperating with the DEP and the academic world is putting together their best minds to make sure we do minimize the impacts.
Well, we have to end on that note, and David Yoxheimer, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's an extension associate with Penn State's Marcellus Center for Outreach and Research in the College of Earth and Mineral Sciences. And Michel Bufado, thank you very much as well.
You're welcome.
And he is chairman of Temple University's Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering, also a member of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Science Advisory Board. We appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. And you can find out much more about the program, including podcasts and Facebook, Twitter, email, archives. It's all there for you. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia and WHYY.org, member-supported public media. And do stay with us for the second hour of Radio Times. David Brooks is our guest, and he's got a brand new book. It's called